Hello, this is Deborah Harper, president of Psych Journey. Welcome to the Psych Journey podcast, www.psychjourneypodcast.com. In a Victorian-era German asylum, seamstress Agnes Richter painstakingly stitched a mysterious autobiographical text into every inch of the jacket she created from her institutional uniform. Despite every attempt to silence them, hundreds of other patients have managed to get their stories out, at least in disguised form. Today, in a vibrant underground network of psychiatric survivor groups all over the world, patients work together to unravel the mysteries of madness and to help one another recover. A vast gulf exists between the way medicine explains psychiatric illness and the experiences of those who suffer. Our guest, Dr. Gail A. Hornstein, author of Agnes's Jacket, A Psychologist's Search for the Meanings of Madness, published by Rodale Books, will help us bridge that gulf, guide us through the inner lives of those diagnosed with mental illness, and offer a new model for understanding one another and ourselves. Gail A. Hornstein is professor of psychology at Holyoke College in South Hadley, Massachusetts. The former chair of the Mount Holyoke Women's Studies Program, Hornstein was founding director of the interdisciplinary Five College Women's Studies Research Center for its first 10 years. Her articles and op-ed pieces have appeared in many scholarly and popular publications, including Newsweek, The Chronicle of Higher Education, The Encyclopedia of Psychology, The American Psychologist, and the Journal of Personality. Her widely reviewed biography, To Redeem One Person is to Redeem the World, The Life of Frieda Fromm Reichman, tells the tale of a pioneering psychiatrist who dedicated herself to treating very disturbed patients. Born in Philadelphia, Hornstein did her undergraduate work at the University of Pittsburgh and earned her PhD from Clark University. She now divides her time between Holyoke, Massachusetts, and London. Visit her website, www.gailhornstein.com. Welcome, Dr. Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Deborah.
Well, the cover of your book was fascinating. I was wishing I could see that jacket. So it's just an amazing work of art, and seems to be the central theme that runs throughout your book. So could you tell us a little bit about Agnes Richter and her amazing jacket?
Agnes Richter, the title character in my book, was a woman who lived in Dresden, Germany in the 1890s. She was, as you mentioned, a seamstress. She made a decent living for herself. She lived on her own. And in the 1890s, she was in her mid-40s. At some point, she began to hear voices. She felt persecuted. She thought people were trying to steal her hard-earned money. And in May of 1893, she was taken by police to the local mental asylum. She was kept there, and she was taken to a nearby state hospital, and she was kept in that mental hospital for the next 23 years until she died in 1916.
23 years.
So she was never let out of the asylum from the time she was taken there, and she was kept there against her will. We know from her case record that she fought constantly to be able to leave the asylum, and she was never allowed to. And as you mentioned, mental patients in 19th century Europe often had to wear uniforms, mm-hmm. like prisoners. They had an institutional outfit that they had to wear. They couldn't wear their own clothes. And as best as I have been able to discover through long research, Agnes seems to have taken her uniform, which was made out of a very coarse linen, taken it apart, because remember, she was a seamstress and she knew mm-hmm. how to do this. She took her uniform apart, it was a very shapeless garment, and re-sewed it into a very beautiful and feminine jacket. The jacket has many details on it that only come from extensive knowledge of stitchery. It has very delicate buttonholes. It has flared cuffs of a very elegant sort. It has something called a peplum that is around the waist. But of course, what's most powerful about the jacket for me is that once she created the jacket itself, on the surface of the jacket, she embroidered in 5 colors of thread and yarn an autobiographical text, which covers every single inch of the jacket. It's on the inside, it's on the outside, it's on the sleeves, it's on the collar, and it is an extraordinary piece of what we would now call textile art.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a visual accomplishment, it's really extraordinary just to look at it. It's very, very beautiful. The 6 colors of thread are very striking. But of course, what's so powerful about it for me is that we see here the intense desire of someone who had no other means available to her to tell the story of her life in a way that could not be confiscated from her. Because one of the things we know about mental patients, hundreds of whom have tried to tell their stories when they were institutionalized, they often have their writing materials confiscated or their notebooks taken away from them or have no other way in which to record anything about their own experience. And so Agnes literally stitched her story into her clothes, which she then wore. This jacket is in a museum in Heidelberg, Germany, and I've seen it a number of times, and we can see the signs of wear. It has perspiration stains on it, and it's very clear that she actually wore this garment. We don't know whether she wore it in secret in the middle of the night or whether she wore it on the ward in front of everyone else to see, which was, if she did that, it would have been very, very extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one of the things that I found your book extraordinary in so many areas, and both the compassion and the research that went into it. But I think for a lot of us, we weren't aware that so many mental patients had tried to, were denied writing materials or were so censored, or even the things where people snuck up, wrote in their own blood when they took ink away from them.
Yes, people have done the most amazing variety of creative things to be able to take account of their experiences and to get their stories out. One of the patients that I talk about, Elizabeth Packard, was an American woman in the 19th century who was, again, like Agnes Richter, institutionalized against her will. And Elizabeth Packard, somewhat similarly to Richter, sewed on the ward. It was often the case in mental hospitals that the staff would appreciate it when women would sew because it was considered to be a domestic art that would keep them calm.
Mm-hmm.
So Elizabeth Packard, who was in a mental institution in Illinois, sewed garments for her children, which was considered to be something appropriate for a woman locked up in a mental hospital. What the staff didn't know was that inside the linings of these garments, she penciled petitions for her release. And her children would take these garments home when they came to visit her on the ward and find when they took them home and went to wear these garments, that they had messages written inside of them.
You know, and both of these examples were from the 19th century, but another interesting thing that ran out is you teach a course of where it's first-person narratives. Yeah, and I'm thinking, gosh, how often even now that we think we're so enlightened do there were so many first-person narratives that, you know, I kind of pride myself. I know a lot of what's out there that I had never heard of that seemed very valuable, that I don't know how much progress we've made in actually hearing people now.
Well, indeed. And the main message of my book is that people who have been mental patients, that is, people who have had unusual or difficult or frightening or disturbing experiences and been diagnosed by some mental health practitioner as having a psychiatric illness, those people have always wanted to talk about their own experiences. And even when it's been difficult for them to do so, they've tried in every possible way. So besides these people who we've just mentioned who don't really have the means to, for instance, write a book about their experiences, the people that I focus on and that I teach about and that I write about in this book, hundreds of them have actually, against all odds, managed to publish accounts of their experiences. So I maintain a bibliography of first-person narratives of madness, and it's now in its fourth edition, and it's got 700 titles on it. And
wow.
These are just the ones that have been published and just the ones that are in English. There are no doubt thousands of others that are either in other languages or are in someone's drawer because they haven't managed to get it published, or they're apprehensive about publishing it because of the concerns of their family or others. So these 700 narratives on the bibliography are just the ones that have been published, and they date from the 15th century until last month. And I update this bibliography repeatedly. People can access it for free on my website. And I think it's so important to see that patients are really trying to provide an alternative viewpoint about their experience from that of mainstream psychiatry. That's the importance of these narratives, is that patients are not only talking about their own personal experiences, but they're presenting ideas about mental illness and its treatment that are radically different from the ideas of especially biological psychiatrists.
Yes, and it seems, I mean, if we step back for a minute, I can't think of any other field of medicine. I mean, mental illness is someone's brain, and yeah, we can take pictures of the brain, et cetera, but we obviously don't know most of what goes on. So how is it possible that in dealing with mental illness, that doctors or psychiatrists or psychologists pay so little attention to the experience of someone with it? Like when we go to a doctor with a physical problem, the first thing they want to know is, what is your experience so I can see what's going on? So there's this strange disconnect between medicine and psychiatry in my mind.
Yes, there is, and it's very distressing to patients themselves and to patients' families,
mm-hmm.
because people often know very clearly what is the cause of their suffering and what would help to make them better. And their ideas are discounted. Now, of course, the main reason why physicians discount them is because our idea of mental illness has within it the notion that someone is irrational. That's what we think mental illness is. And so we think if someone's irrational, if there's something wrong with their minds, then how can they have any insight into their experience? That's where that idea comes from. But in my own research and in the work that I've done with these first-person narratives, and not only the published ones, but now there are many oral histories, there are websites, there are videotaped testimonies, all by patients telling the story of their experiences and their difficulties. What I've found over and over again is that, contrary to what we would think from mainstream psychiatry, patients are extraordinarily insightful about their difficulties. They know a great deal about what has made them suffer, and they have many productive, practical, and creative ideas about what would help them and help their families cope better. And I think especially I mention families because so many family members themselves suffer because of not knowing what to do to help their relative who is diagnosed with a mental illness.
Would it be fair to say that part of what also would, in my mind, have a major influence on the disconnect is that to really listen to someone and pay attention and spend the time, you know, time is money, and for the psychiatrist or the psychiatrist, you know, similar to those of us who want to go for personal therapy, it's now, okay, you can see somebody six times, and oh, wow, you're cured. It's much cheaper to just have them in for 15 minutes and give them whatever pill of the month is.
Well, it might be cheaper, but it's certainly less effective. And,
oh, yeah, two separate issues, effective and cheaper.
Well, one of the things that I emphasize in this book, which I discovered during the research, is the extraordinary importance of peer support groups, that
mm-hmm.
is, groups that patients have organized themselves, usually outside of the mental health system, which they've organized themselves and run themselves. And most people don't know, and this is a lot what my book focuses on, that there are hundreds of such groups all over the world. Because they're usually outside of the mental health system, people don't know about them. But they are amazingly effective in providing exactly what you're talking about, that is a context where people can talk directly about their own experience and have others listen empathically to what they're going through.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think most people would, just based on our stereotypes of mental patients, we would think, well, if you get a lot of mental patients together in a room, how could they help each other, because they're all irrational, and how could they be paying any attention to each other, and wouldn't they each just be hallucinating and not really understanding one another? And that's really our stereotype, but that is completely wrong. In the research for my book, I've spent 6 years going to these groups, thanks to the invitations of patients who have been supportive of my effort to try to understand their perspective. I've gone to dozens of groups, and what happens in those groups is completely opposite to what that stereotype would suggest. Even people who are in tremendous distress themselves listen very empathically to other people. They offer practical advice. They are deeply interested in listening to what someone else has gone through, how they experience their difficulties, what they think is important to them. And this kind of attentive listening and the pragmatic suggestions that people make to one another have demonstrable benefits. Even, I've seen again and again, people who have been in the mental health system for 20 years, who
mm-hmm.
have been tried on every medication, who have had ECT, who have had other kinds of difficult treatments and have not responded to those, have been in peer support groups and found real help and gotten significantly, if not completely, better.
Yeah, one of the things I found the descriptions of the various groups and on different countries and different social groups, so it was a very broad sampling and very intense, like you said, over 6 years, is like what you mentioned before, many people would have the thing, well, you know, it'd be just chaotic or they wouldn't listen to each other. Not only that, there was no person there who was in charge of it or the boss or directing everything. It was very, very self-directed. And even with, to get the normal, you know, six people we pick off the street in a group, I think many of us think, well, we're going to have somebody there to be the boss and enforce the rules and do the structure.
Well, indeed, that's what's so powerful. And
mm-hmm.
that's the sense in which when I'm talking about peer support groups, I mean something that's very different from, say, group therapy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in group therapy, there's a therapist who is a trained mental health professional, and while the other members of the group might also be helpful to someone, in group therapy, the therapist is, in a sense, directing the group. Whereas
mm-hmm.
these peer support groups, there's no one directing the group. There might be a facilitator, or people might take turns facilitating. But, for example, in the groups that I focus on in the book, groups for people who have the experience that psychiatrists call auditory hallucinations, but people in these groups call hearing voices, because
mm-hmm.
that's a more neutral way of describing it. It's less stigmatized. In hearing voices groups, of which there are hundreds all over the world and are organized into something called the Hearing Voices Network, it's a very, very powerful federation of these groups based in England. In hearing voices groups, people have had very, very difficult kinds of experiences. The experiences that psychiatrists call psychotic, that are associated with mental illnesses like schizophrenia. And again, contrary to stereotype, what they do in these groups is to listen attentively to one another, make thoughtful interpretations of each other's experience, ask helpful questions about what someone's been going through, about what might make their voices or other disturbing experiences worse, what are the situations where they're worse, when are they better? Because that's another one of our stereotypes about mental illness, is that
mm-hmm.
we think that someone is disturbed at every minute of the day. But that's never true. People have their difficulties, as they call it, triggered by certain kinds of stressful events. And if they can identify some of those triggers, they can avoid those situations, or they can change how they act in them, and do things that will really be concretely helpful.
It's nice. Also, in even more than, or in addition to the day-to-day management, I found it very moving and powerful how sometimes the voices, they would get an insight that, you know, like example of someone who had been sexually abused as a child or abused in other ways, how the voices were a reflection of the trauma they went to. And when they were heard, they could somehow step back or be free a little bit from that trauma, and the voices would change. Could you share a little bit about that?
Yes, that's one of the most important lessons that I've learned from my experiences in visiting these Hearing Voices groups and in helping, I should add, helping to facilitate one. We now
mm-hmm.
have one right here where I live in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and I co-facilitate it with someone who hears voices himself. Trauma has been shown again and again to be one of the major origins for very disturbing experiences like hallucinations. In some studies in Europe, the estimate is that up to 80% of people who end up with a symptom like hallucinations have had some demonstrable trauma early in their lives. And the earlier it was, the more prolonged it was, and the more severe it was, the more likely they are to end up later on having a very disturbing experience like hallucinations. In Hearing Voices groups, people do what I think most of us would think would be the obvious thing to do, and yet it's hardly ever done, namely to ask people about what the voices say.
It sounded to me that that wasn't the first question.
I know. One of the most distressing things for people who hear voices is that when they see psychiatrists or other physicians, they may be asked many different questions about their symptoms, and if they say yes to a question like, do you hear voices,
mm-hmm.
usually that's the end of the interview.
Really?
And the psychiatrist will say, okay, you have this symptom, I'm going to give you this medication in the hopes of getting rid of these voices. And what patients say is that even though the voices might be very distressing, and some people are completely tormented by these voices who scream at them inside their
mm-hmm.
head, for hours at a time in a terrifying way. Even when that's their experience, still people believe, and this is one of the major appeals of Hearing Voices groups, that the voices mean something, that there is a symbolic significance to what they're saying, that it means something if the voice is the voice of a man, or the voice is the voice of a woman, or the voice of a child, or if it's the voice of someone they recognize in their life,
mm-hmm.
or it's a voice with a foreign accent of a certain kind, or what the content is of what the voice says. And in Hearing Voices groups, people ask each other very detailed questions about their voices in an effort to help the person contextualize them so that they can realize, okay, my voices are worse in these kinds of situations. What is it about this situation that's making me feel more stressed? What
mm-hmm.
can I do about that? Or my voice is saying to me, don't trust anyone else. Don't speak to anyone else. Why would I have a voice that's saying that to me? Did something happen to me where someone threatened me and said, don't ever tell anyone about this?
Right. Yeah, that just makes perfect sense to me. And
it
also,
makes perfect sense to me, too, but it's amazing how this is not the viewpoint that psychiatrists typically take.
I mean, I might put myself at the risk of being called crazy and locked up, but when I have my version of this, which is not hallucinatory, but, you know, more like an internal tape, what I find helpful is talking back to the voices.
Yes, that's something that people often encourage one another to do in Hearing Voices groups. Of course, you need to do that in an appropriate context. If people do that on the street, they're likely to get into trouble. But if they do that in their own homes, and they basically create a kind of dialogue with the voice or the voices, first of all, they feel much less powerless, which is a very important first step.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, they can often understand better what the voices are doing there. Why are they there? What do they want, so to speak? You may know that the famous psychoanalyst Carl Jung had this kind of experience himself, and he writes about it in his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. And he talks about how he he engaged in a dialogue with his voices,
mm-hmm.
and he learned an enormous amount about the unconscious and how the mind works. And, you know, he's a famous psychoanalyst. He's not a locked-up schizophrenic patient.
Yeah, I would think as a concrete example that comes to my mind, where you talked about someone's hearing voices of you better not tell and threatening, the image that immediately came to my mind was, you know, sexual abuse or some
yes.
type of physical abuse when someone's very young. And
yes.
My talking back would be, hello, I got my growth.
Yes.
Want to take me on now?
Yes, yes. Well, of course we know, though, that if you have a very, very distressing symptom like this,
mm-hmm.
it can be just so terrifying. You can basically feel, especially if you've never had an opportunity to talk about it,
right.
you feel like the same terrified child that was going through that experience. And most people, of course, don't want to hear about things that are this frightening.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to talk about something like this, say, with your family. And that's why hearing voices groups are so important.
Well, particularly if your family inflicted it on you.
Well, that could be, but it also could
yeah.
be, it's very, very distressing to even the most supportive family member to hear about something like this that
mm-hmm.
seems so strange. It seems strange, it seems weird, it seems like something that you just want to get rid of. And that's where we can understand the appeal of, you know, giving someone a medication that might just make the voices go away. And if that always worked, maybe that would be a good idea. But unfortunately, in many, many cases, medication either doesn't work at all, or it what people report is that it dampens down the voices and makes them have a lower volume in a way that's even more distressing. So it sounds, for instance, like a radio that's turned down to a low volume. You can almost hear it. And many people report that that's even more distressing to them because it's completely distracting. They can't hear what the voices are saying, but they also can't ignore them.
Now, this might be a stretch, but again, something that comes to my mind is, say, it's an example of someone who as a child was overpowered and either physically or sexually abused, and the voice is their own internal reenactment or post-traumatic stress in some ways about that. My initial response on the drugging, though it might be effective in some cases, I could see how I would perceive that as the voices might be lessened, but now that I have this drug, particularly with all the side effects and that go along with it, in some ways I would feel now I am back to being immobilized and even more in a vulnerable state.
Many people do feel that way. Although, you know, one of the main messages that I am trying to convey in this book is that people's experiences of emotional distress, and I have learned from the patients that I've worked with that that's a better word to use, emotional
mm-hmm.
distress, rather than something like mental illness, which is very stigmatizing and we don't really know that it's an illness and so on. People's experiences of emotional distress are extremely variable. And one of the things that I hope people will take away from this book is that we really can't generalize. Medication works for some people. It doesn't work for other people. It works for some people for a while, and then they develop a toxic reaction to it, and they need some other kind of strategy. Many people feel, as you just suggested, powerless if they can't do anything to help themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they just are taking a pill. If the pill stops working, what do? So that's why I'm so impressed that in the peer support groups that I am focusing on, people are helping one another to develop very pragmatic coping strategies that they can do whether or not they're on medication. They can do whether or not they're living on their own. They can do in any kind of context, some of which are quite sensible, some of which are ones that they wouldn't have thought of themselves. And I've seen people week after week, and as I say, we started a hearing voices group here in Massachusetts, and it's been meeting for almost a year now. And I see these people every single week, and there are dramatic differences in their ability to just live more normal lives, to cope with the difficulties that face all of us, and to find ways to deal with trauma from the past or in the present in ways that are more effective and keep them, for instance, out of the mental hospitals.
Well, I found your I find your point very well taken and very important that it is individual. And my thought would be, even if, you know, for many people, medicine is the way to go, but they would, I would think one of the benefits of these groups is if they made a decision to take medication or stay on medication, it's their decision. It's
Absolutely.
Not once more an authority figure in some ways reenacting the original trauma by you will, shut up, do what you're told.
Yes, absolutely. One of the groups that I've worked the most with, which I feature in the book and which is here in my area in Massachusetts, it's called Freedom Center.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called that for precisely the reason that you're mentioning. The whole viewpoint of Freedom Center is to encourage people to take an open-minded attitude toward their own difficulties and the difficulties of other people, and to respect people's individual choices, their freedom, to make decisions about what is most helpful to them. So at Freedom Center support group meetings, which I write a lot about in the book, there are people who take medication. There are people who have weaned themselves off of medication.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who have developed other kinds of strategies, like stress reduction techniques, like yoga or meditation or dietary changes. There are people who have worked in more structured programs in the mental health system. And the thing that I find so admirable about groups like this is that they really take just that attitude that you are describing of mutual respect and of an encouragement that people should think about what is best for them and to decide that in an ongoing way. And what's best for you at one time might not be best for you the next year. To take an active role in their own healing and to constantly, this is one of the most important messages that I hope people will take, to constantly reinforce the fact, and I have seen this personally over and over again, that people can recover fully even from the most severe difficulties. So even people who have had a diagnosis of schizophrenia for 20 years, who have been in every hospital, who have taken every medication, who have been given shock treatment, who have had every possible kind of experience in the mental health system, still can get completely better. And this is one of the things that I think is so important for all of us to realize, because there's been a lot of pessimism in the world of psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
People are told, well, you know, give up on your family member because they're never going to be any better than they are now, or give up on yourself. You need to face the fact that you have a chronic mental illness and you're just not going to recover and, you know, kind of do the best you can but don't have very many hopes. That's wrong. That's just wrong.
Oh, I agree with you. And as another thing that runs through your book that I think is very important, so I'd like to mention briefly, is because your research is based both in England and in the United States, you do an excellent job of really showing how, obviously there's differences between our mental health systems and medical structure, et cetera, but how a different matter of integration and welcoming to the Voices Network and the patient support movement in our country and in England, and kind of like, well, you know, why is that? Or I just think it strengthens the argument. If it was just one country, it'd be much easier for people to go, oh, no, it just wouldn't work. It's not valuable. It's like, wait a minute, something very different over here. We're not that different.
Well, one of the big differences in the United States is that psychiatry in the United States is very, very heavily biological.
Mm-hmm.
And very focused on medication. And we don't really get a viewpoint from psychiatrists in the United States that is much different from that. Whereas in other places in the world, especially Europe and in the UK, social psychiatry is an important part of the practice of psychiatry. So if you go to a psychiatrist in Germany or Holland, for example, they are likely to see racism, poverty, trauma, abuse, as just as likely to be a cause of emotional difficulties or mental illness as a brain dysfunction is.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the United States, there is a tremendous focus on brain functioning. And, you know, as I say often to my students at Mount Holyoke College, of course we have brains, and every one of us, for every one of us, our brain functioning is essential to our well-being. There's no question about that. And that's true of people with emotional distress, and it's true of you and me. We couldn't be having this interview right now if we didn't have highly functioning brains and couldn't listen to one another and understand each other and speak clearly and so on. But the idea that it's a brain dysfunction that causes people's emotional difficulties is one viewpoint. And it may be the dominant viewpoint among psychiatrists in the United States, but it's not the dominant viewpoint among psychiatrists in other places. And because it's so dominant here, it tends to crowd out other alternative ways of looking at emotional difficulties. And that's one of the reasons why patients have so often gone off on their own, really, to create their own alternatives, either in, as we were talking about earlier, in the narratives they've written about their experiences or in these peer support groups, to provide more optimistic, holistic, and I think we could say realistic alternatives to the pessimism that unfortunately has been so much a part of American psychiatry.
I think the cross-cultural research you did and the case studies you showed and your own experiences is just incredibly valuable. Because I think as a cliche, but I think there's some truth to it, Americans do tend to think, you know, we're the center of the universe and we're not as informed as we should be, that there's other point of views and other ways of doing things.
Yes, and you know, what's so surprising is that the United States is the culture that invented self-help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're the ones that came up with the idea that people could be in self-help groups of all sorts. So, you know, we encourage people who are experiencing bereavement or drug abuse or alcoholism or parenting difficulties to go to self-help groups or peer support groups. A group like AA was developed in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to mental illness, we don't think that such groups are effective. It's so surprising. And when I speak in England, where there are hundreds of such groups, people always say, how can it be? The United States invented self-help. How can it be that there aren't so many peer support groups for people struggling with emotional difficulties in the U.S.? And it is kind of an irony of our system.
Now, the 6 years of research you did for Agnosis Jacket, I mean, my goodness, you're going back and forth between countries and tracking down meetings, and it wasn't like you really had to pass some tests even to get into the meeting. It was like it was all-encompassing part of your life for a number of years. How did it change your understanding of mental illness and your views of your own profession?
It had a profound change, and that's really why I wrote this book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a psychology professor. I'm not a psychotherapist. I don't treat people with mental difficulties. As I often say when I go to peer support groups, when they've invited me as a guest, I often introduce myself and say, I'm not a therapist, I've never put anyone in a hospital, I've never given anyone a medication. I'm a psychology professor, and I'm interested in how the mind works.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a very experienced psychology professor. I've been teaching for 30 years, and I have wonderful students at Mount Holyoke, which is the oldest women's college in the United States, and I have been teaching these young women, as I say, for 30 years, and have been increasingly frustrated by what I myself learned in graduate school about mental illness and what most mental health professionals believe, especially about schizophrenia, psychotic depression, bipolar illness, that is, these serious forms of difficulty. The standard viewpoint in abnormal psychology textbooks is that these are chronic disorders from which people cannot recover, that they are, I'm going to put quotes around this in the air, out of touch with reality, unable to take the role of the other. These are all the things that I learned. And in my research for this book, I found again and again that these classic claims about mental illness are wrong. They're just wrong. People may be in times of distress, and when they're in very acute distress, they may have trouble focusing for instance, but I think that's true of all of us.
Oh, definitely.
If someone's in a rage, they really can't listen to other people.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually they come out of that rage. And even people who have very disturbing psychotic experiences don't have them 24 hours a day. And one of the things that we can really learn, and I have certainly learned in my own work, is if someone's having tremendous difficulty, when they're in a calmer period, ask them directly, what would help? What should I do when you're like that?
Mm-hmm.
When you're running around the house screaming, what should I do? What would help calm down the situation then? And people often know very, very precisely what would help. And if we could listen to them more attentively, especially when they're feeling calmer, we could learn a tremendous amount, and certainly as I have. And one of the reasons why I wrote this book, and certainly the reason why I teach a class every fall at Mount Holyoke on narratives of madness written by patients, is to educate students, psychology students, to think about madness in a different way, to listen to the viewpoints of people who have direct first-person experience, and to change some of these stereotypic ideas that we've had that really just are not warranted.
Well, I just think you succeeded admirably in your book. I cannot recommend it highly enough. How has your book been received by your peers?
You know, it's just come out, so I can't yet answer questions about its reaction. It's only been out for a couple of weeks, so I very much look forward to hearing responses from all kinds of people.
Mm-hmm. So could you please give our listeners again the title of your book and the URL of your website?
Yes, my book is called Agnes's Jacket, A Psychologist's Search for the Meanings of Madness. And my website is www.gailhornstein.com. That's GAILHORNSTEIN.com.
Well, Dr. Hornstein, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on the Psych Journey podcast.
I thank you so much.